This is a little scary for me. You're quite an imposing group. I had not anticipated this large a crowd. And so emotionally, I'm not prepared for it. One woman is one thing, but this is entirely something else. 2 or 3 years ago, Carol and I, after our daughter left home and started to college, found ourselves in a rather unusual situation that is unusual to us, because for the past several years we'd had a daughter living with us who consumed a great deal of our time, and now it was just the two of us. And we have found out since then that a lot of couples face this same situation, but we began to pray and think about how we could begin to develop a ministry together, because prior to that our paths had taken separate ways for the most part as far as ministry was concerned. And as we prayed about this and thought about it, the Lord began to open some doors for us to put together a seminar on the husband-wife relationship. And it started out as a little deal that would consume about 2 hours. And now it has grown to the place where we take somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 hours on it. And so we are faced with a rather difficult task this morning to try and communicate to you in 1 hour anything that is a reasonable facsimile of making sense on how to understand your mate. And I'm sure that most of you here realize that we could not even begin to cover all that's involved in that in 1 hour. But we're going to take a stab at it. And we're primarily going to talk about two things. I'll cover one aspect of it, and Carol will cover another. But usually, when we have the time, we get into such things as communications between husband and wife, the role of the husband in the home as the leader and the lover, the role of the wife in the home as the helpmate, the mother, the mistress. The spiritual dimensions of the marriage relationship and the physical relationship. These are some of the things that we cover. So perhaps sometime we can get a chance to take a shot at both you and your husbands. That's how we like to do it, to put the thing on for husbands and wives, having you there together. And Carol shares it from a woman's viewpoint, and I share it from a husband's viewpoint. So anyway, we're delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you this morning. I think one of the things that is becoming obvious as far as the marriage relationship here in America is concerned is that the American home is slowly going on the rocks. In fact, really not too slowly. The divorce rate in the United States is rapidly climbing toward the 50% mark. One out of every two marriages. And in some major metropolitan areas such as Seattle, Chicago, New York, Dallas, it is already beyond that. There are more divorces in major metropolitan areas in a year than there are marriages. Recently, I read an article in the Chicago Tribune that had to do with the American housewife. And at one point in the article, it mentioned that 40% of all the attempts at suicide in the United States today are by housewives. Now, to me, that speaks volumes that there's something basically wrong with the American home today. Recently, this has been several months ago, I am not an avid reader of Red Book, but occasionally, my wife will pick it up at the newsstand and I'll glance through it. And on even rarer occasions, I'll find an article that attracts my attention, and so I'll read it. And several months ago, we had a Red Book laying around the house and I picked it up, and it had to do with divorce in the middle years. And it was written by a gal who was totally unsuccessful at this. And I think this was one of the things that griped me about it. She was trying to give advice to people regarding her failure. And what had happened, basically, in their relationship is that this gal and this guy had met, had fallen in love, had gotten married, had had three children. He had his job, she had the home and the kids. And over a period of years, the only thing that kept them anywhere close to one another was the children. But they were not realizing this at the time the process was taking place. They probably had some inkling of the fact that their lives were drifting further and further and further apart, but because of the kids being there, there was a rallying point. And then one day, they woke up and the kids were gone. They'd gotten married, they'd left for college, they were no longer there, and the two of them, husband and wife, after 17 or 18 or 20 years of marriage, found themselves again alone. And they had absolutely nothing in common. They were total strangers to one another. And what happened was they ended up in divorce. Now, ladies, this is not an uncommon occurrence in the United States today. This is happening more and more as you get close to this situation of what is happening with older, middle-aged couples. And they're ending up in the divorce courts. Ask the question, how many married couples do you know who have what can be called a love affair? That is, of course, with each other. How many couples do you know who you could describe their relationship with each other as a love affair? They are really in love with one another, and it shows. It shows in every aspect of their relationship. When you're in the home, when you're out having dinner with them, wherever you may be with them. Well, the answer that is most often given to this question is, well, I think most of my friends have pretty good marriages. They seem to be happy. But that doesn't really answer the question, does it? Someone, I think it was Eric Fromm, the psychologist, said that we have reached such a low point in our expectations of marriage that most couples would rate their marriages as good if they can simply keep from fighting. Now, this suggestion that a man and a woman have a good thing going for them if they lived with an armed truce is rather a sad state of affairs, and yet this is close to what most of the happily harassed married couples are experiencing on your block. If you were to go around the block and you could really get inside their hearts and their homes and know what is really happening, this would be the situation. Pretty much an armed truce, and sometimes not even that, if you're listening very closely outside their front door on occasion. Now, ladies, my contention and Carol's contention is that this need not be so. This was not the way it was planned. The way that the home and the marriage relationship is going in America today, and for that matter all over the world, but we're thinking primarily of the United States, the way it is going right now is not the way it was planned to go. It is not the way God intended for it to go. And after all, God created marriage. He invented the thing. Sometimes we seem to forget that. But God made the institution of marriage. He formed it. He planned it. And he had some specific and definite goals in mind for it to accomplish. And one of those goals was happiness between a man and a woman. And joy. A thrilling, exciting experience. Not for a couple of years, but for a lifetime. Now, I want to take you into the first three chapters of Genesis, because that's where it all started. And I don't want you to turn me off right now, because this is kind of exciting, and I'm going to try and liven it up a little bit for you. Because when you read it, you know, just as it is, if you don't have a little bit of a sanctified imagination, you can lose some of the content that is really there. Now, near the end of chapter 1, God says that God, in his book here, he says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Now that was the end of God's creative endeavor. He had made the heavens and the earth and all the animals and the flowers and the trees and the heavens and the earth. And then he looked around and he says of his creation at that point, he said, this is good. It is good. But he thought in his mind, there is one thing missing. And that is a living man. And so he created a man and a woman. And after he had done that, down at the end of the chapter, in the last verse, it says this, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. See, the capstone of God's creation was man and woman. He could relate to a man and a woman. He couldn't relate to a tree, to the sky, to the earth, to the flowers, to the animals, but to a man and a woman. The Creator could relate to them, and he wanted them to relate to him. And so when he got finished with all of his creation, and he looked it over, including man and woman, he said, not that it's just good, but it's very good. And ladies, we are a part of that this morning. We are a part of God's creation, which he looks upon and he says, it is very good. And the expression of his heart is love. He loves us. He created us and he loves us. Now, you get into chapter 2 then, and he goes back, and the writer gives us a little more of the details of what actually took place. Chapter 1 is kind of an overview, and then chapter 2 comes back and puts in some of the details. For instance, it says in verse 18 of chapter 2, then the Lord said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him. Not a helper to give him fits, but a helper fit for him. Now notice what God says. Notice the observation that he made about a man alone. He's lonely. Now, it's kind of interesting when you get the picture of the context, because here is Adam now. God has made him. He has put him in this fantastic creation that he's made in the Garden of Eden, which, you know, is the epitome of all pleasure and beauty and wonder. And that's where Adam was living. He had God. He had the whole earth. He had the Garden of Eden. And yet God in his wisdom looks down with Adam having all of that and he says, you know, that guy's lonely. Even though he has all this, he's lonely. And folks, just parenthetically, that is the condition of a lot of people's hearts today. Trying to think of a man's name, a Swiss psychiatrist, I can't remember his name right now, slips me, but he made a statement shortly before his death. He says, the central neurosis of our times is emptiness, emptiness of heart. And Hemingway, shortly before he took a shotgun and blew his brains out by sticking it in his mouth and pulling the trigger, he made a statement, he says, my life is as empty as a radio vacuum tube with the juice turned off. Now, ladies, a lot of hearts in the world today, both men and women, are just like that. There's a God-shaped vacuum, someone has said, in the heart of every man that only God can fill. Loneliness. It's a terrible thing. It makes a man or a woman desperate. Well, the thing I'm talking about right now goes far beyond the thing that God recognized in Adam's life at this point, because Adam did have God. But there was something missing, and so God says, I know exactly what it is he needs. He needs a woman. And so he proceeds. Now there's a little parenthetical couple of verses in here. It says, God said, it's not good that man should live alone. I will make him a helper fit for him. And that to me is a beautiful statement. A helper fit for him. Made just to meet his requirements. Just exactly what he needs. She will be designed and created just for him. And gals, that is God's plan for every man and woman. It's not only true of the woman for the man, but it's also true of the man for the woman. That God has a special person picked out that's just designed and made for you. And he intends for that to be fulfilled. A helper fit for him. So, out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to the man to see what he'd call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all cattle and the birds of the air and every beast of the field. Can you imagine what that job would have been like if Eve had been on the scene at that time? Adam would still be at it. You know, the humor and yet the wisdom of God's timing, huh? But for the man, there was not found a helper fit for him. So, the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from woman, he made into a woman, and brought her to the man. Now, can you picture that? Adam had never seen a woman before. And here he was in this beautiful, romantic setting. And God has performed this miracle. He's made this gal just fit for him. She was beautiful. And in she walks. Wow. And Adam says, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." Now, what he was really saying in the vernacular was, man alive, she is really something. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of the man. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. And thus God not only created man and woman, but he also invented the marriage relationship. A man shall leave his father and mother. He'll cleave unto his wife, and the two of them become one. Now that, ladies, is a unique thing that God has done in creating the marriage relationship. And yet, why is there so much sadness? Why is there so much unhappiness accompanying it? Why right now, in your own heart, are some of you saying, I wish my marriage relationship was happy. I wish I had the kind of a relationship that was really satisfying, that was fulfilling. What is wrong? What's gone wrong over the years? Why isn't it the way it ought to be? Well, let me suggest a reason for you to think about as a possibility for a starting place to maybe begin to shore up some of the problems that exist and cope with them in your own marriage relationship. You see, after this big event took place, you get into chapter 3, and we find that Adam and Eve get into some trouble with God. Now, you know the story of the tree, of the knowledge of good and evil, how the Lord had forbidden them to partake of that. But Eve gets this bright idea that she's going to grab a little bit of that fruit, see how it tastes, and she likes it so well, she gets Adam involved, and he also sins against God through disobedience. Now, there's an interesting way that it's stated here in Scripture. Listen to this. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And then, of course, she gave it to her husband. And then it says down in verse 8, right at the end of it, it says, "And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God." They saw, they desired, they took, and then they hid from God because they knew in their heart that they had disobeyed, that they had sinned against the Lord. And sin always separates, even on a human level, but especially on the God-man level, it separates. But even on a human level, it separates. Ladies, you go out and have an affair with another man other than your husband. And it goes on for a while, and one day your husband finds out about it. What happens in your relationship with him? The minute he finds out, the minute that knowledge and that information comes to him and he finds out that it's true, there is a parting, there is a separation, there is a gulf that exists between the two of you from that point on until it's resolved in some way or another. You have sinned against him, and sin always separates. And that's what has happened between man and God. That's what happened here with this couple and God. And see, when God made man, he intended that man go on living on the earth in a happy, unique relationship with himself. Then when he created woman, that for man to be his helpmeet, a woman fit for him, that they should have a relationship that was similar in fashion to that which he had established between himself and man. So that really it's a triangular thing in the marriage relationship. You got the man down here in one corner, the woman here, and then God up in the top corner. And really, in essence, what you can say is that the closer the man and the woman come to God, the closer their relationship comes to each other. And I have seen that happen over and over and over again in a marriage relationship that was going on the rocks. The man, the husband, the wife, they get their hearts right with God. They begin to get closer to him, and their hearts are knit and drawn to one another. Now that is the starting place. And so I think the question I would leave with you and ask you this morning is, how is your relationship with God? Yours personally. I'm not talking about your husband right now. I'm talking about you. Is there a separation there? Has this gulf been in existence for some time? Through sin on your part. Oh, I'm not talking necessarily about active participation in great immorality or sin of that kind, or necessarily even shaking your fist in the face of God and saying, "I don't want to have anything to do with you." But how about just passively ignoring God, leaving him out of your life totally? You know, there are a lot of people walking around on the earth today that I refer to as practical atheists. Oh, verbally, they say, "Oh yeah, I believe in God." They go to church. They live a fairly moral life. But if you follow them around for 24 hours or a week, you find that God has absolutely no place in their life as far as the practical everyday living is concerned. They just ignore him. They're not mad at him or anything, but they just leave him out. Well, that is not the place that God intended or wants to have in your life. And so what has developed is a separation between you and God because of your neglect of him, because of sin of some kind or another. The Bible says all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and thus this great gulf has been fixed. And that's why Jesus Christ came into the world. It's right at that point that he entered the earth's history. It's why he lived here on this earth for some 33 years and why he died on a cross, in order to restore and reestablish the possibility of a relationship between sinful man and holy God. And he says to us, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to his life and live with him and fellowship with him." It's by invitation only that Jesus Christ enters a person's life. And then he comes in and he takes up residence. And he begins to give fulfillment and meaning and reality to life in a dimension that the individual has never experienced before. He frees that person from the feeling of guilt that they have down in their heart. They begin to establish a relationship with God for the first time that is meaningful and has reality to it. And then once that happens, ladies, in the life of a husband and a wife, they now have a basis of establishing a relationship that can become beautiful and happy and fulfilling and unique. And I say unique because there are not very many like that in the world today. And so maybe that's where you need to start in working on your marriage relationship. If you have problems, if you've got questions, maybe what you need to do is examine your own heart and your own relationship to the Lord and find out if He has been left out. Does He have a meaningful place in your life? And you get your heart right with the Lord and go from there. I'll tell you one thing it'll do for you. Beyond all the spiritual dimensions, it will open your eyes to some new things about your husband that you've never seen before. God will give you understanding and wisdom that you've never experienced before. He will give you the ability to be the kind of wife that your husband wants you to be and that you want to be down deep in your hearts. So, that's where to begin. Now, how do you go about understanding that guy that you're living with? Well, that's a big subject, but Carol's going to take a crack at it. And just before she comes up, let me read you a little thing that we came across some time ago. It's entitled, How to Tell a Man from a Woman. Now, most of us probably figure we got that figured out. This is some highlighted observations on the nature of he's and she's. What is a man? Well, a man is a creature of superlative intelligence who can understand the principle of jet propulsion and the Dow Jones averages. But he can't figure out how to fold a baby's diaper. He can't understand the rules for Monopoly, and he can't grasp the basic theory of the hook and eye. A man has a remarkably retentive memory. He can recall the score of the Army-Navy game in 1948, the electoral votes the Republicans won in the last election, and the gas mileage of his first car. But he can't remember what size socks he wears, the ages of his children, or the name of that old Richard Rogers number that his wife refers to as our song. And what is a woman? Well, a woman is a rattle brain who can't read a slide rule, can't follow a road map, and is vague about the make and model of the car she drives. But she can recall in vivid detail the yellow organdy dress she wore to her high school prom. She can mentally multiply 16 people by 2.5 cheese canopies each while she's cooking beef stroganoff, iron a blouse, helping one child compose a letter to Santa Claus, and listening to another practice scales on the piano. A man has astounding manual dexterity. He can light a match with his fingernail. He can untangle a hopelessly snarled fishing line. He can repair a light cord, fix a carburetor, operate a power saw, and park a 17-foot car in a 16-foot parking space. A woman can't do anything like that, but she can hang up a bath towel so that the monogram is right side out and precisely centered. Fantastic. She can unjam a stuck zipper. She can construct a pin curl and remove a sliver and balance a plate of food on her lap. A man is decisive. He can make instantaneous decisions about mergers and advertising campaigns, cutbacks in production, and million-dollar bond issues. But he has to appeal to his wife, that little muddlehead who can't decide how much to tip a bellboy, to help him decide which necktie to wear with his blue suit and what to send his mother for her birthday. Faced with a continental menu, he shrugs helplessly and asks, "Honey, do I like beef bourguignon?" A man is stoical about thunderstorms and rattlesnakes and spiders. He's fearless about guns and one-engine planes, and he'd give his eye teeth to be an astronaut. He has tremendous physical stamina and thinks it's great fun to spend all day in a cold duck blind. On the other hand, a woman is a weak, timorous creature who lies awake hearing strange noises after reading a news bulletin that a psychopathic killer has escaped from a prison 1,500 miles away. But she doesn't quail in terror with a new baby. She'll brave the rigors of an August white sale. And she has an adventurous attitude toward the unidentifiable hors d'oeuvres. When she doesn't feel well, she does a very courageous thing. She goes to a doctor. A man has quick reflexes and keenly developed eyesight and hearing. He can keep track of the ball at a football game. He can detect an engine knock that is inaudible to the feminine ear. But he can't hear a baby crying for its bottle in the middle of the night. And he can't use the telephone if a child is banging two pot lids together in the next room. A man has great presence of mind in a crisis. He's a mountain of strength in a hurricane. He keeps his head when passing a truck at 60 miles an hour. He has a calm, philosophical attitude about permanents that turn out frizzy and ovens that go on the blink 2 hours before a dinner party. But he loses his head in a maternity ward, becomes a bundle of nerves during spring cleaning, and is inconsolable when his golf game goes sour. Men are practical, hard-headed realists, quite unlike women, who are notoriously childlike when it comes to anything concerning money. With paper, pencil, and patent logic, a man can prove the folly of transferring a savings account from one bank to another in order to get a $3.95 set of steak knives absolutely free. But, on the other hand, he has implicit faith in hot market tips, and he can use the same paper and pencil to prove that buying a new car is cheaper in the long run than getting two new tires for the old one. A man has a sixth sense that enables him to find his way through the clover leaf, under the overpass, over the viaduct, across the bridge, and straight east to the airport without making a single wrong turn in ample time to meet the 10:30 plane from Seattle. However, a woman has a sixth sense that prompts her to keep telling him, "George, I have a funny feeling we're headed in the wrong direction." But a woman can find the adhesive tape in the medicine cabinet. She has an uncanny prophetic sense that tells her when to arrive at a dinner party. All in all, a man is absolutely indispensable. He is brilliant, resourceful, brave, strong, steady, a rock to lean upon. But it is his utter helplessness that's his greatest asset. Because it gives his wife, that little flutter brain who can't open a jar of pickles, the certain knowledge that she is indispensable too, and that he couldn't get along without her. And indeed, he couldn't. Come to think of it, this isn't such a bad state of affairs after all. Now, Carol is going to come up and talk to you about the differences between men and women, which are more than obvious. And this is something that we have discovered down through the years, that many women, men and women, do not really grasp the significance of in really understanding each other. And so it's a real treat, gals, for me to introduce to you not only my wife, but the gal that I've been married to and living with for the last 25 years, and who I love very dearly. And she's not only my wife, but she is a real helper. She's the best counselor that I have. She's my best friend, and she's my lover.
Isn't he great? Charles Schulz, the creator of the famous Peanuts cartoon, sometimes has great insight into the human personality. And I couldn't help but grin at a cartoon that he created a while back. Peppermint Patty is going along and she's saying, "I don't know why I even think about him." Then she's sitting under a tree and she says, "Chuck just doesn't seem to understand a girl's emotions. In fact, Chuck doesn't seem to understand girls at all. Chuck is hard to talk to because he doesn't understand life. He doesn't understand laughing and crying." And by this time, she's headed for his house. And she says, "He doesn't understand love and silly talk and touching hands and things like that. He plays a lot of baseball, but I doubt if he even understands baseball." By this time, she's at his house and she's knocking at the door. And Charlie Brown sticks his head out and Peppermint Patty says, "I don't think you understand anything, Chuck." And then she walks away. And Chuck stands there with this hopelessly defeated look on his face. And he kind of bewilderedly says, "I don't even understand what it is I don't understand." And we have so much to understand, don't we? In this business of understanding men or understanding anybody. We have to understand their personality type and our own. We have to understand the extrovert-introvert differences that so many of us live with. We have to understand their backgrounds and their hang-ups. And then we have to understand this basic difference between men and women, which we're going to take a little time to discuss today. Now, as we discuss these, let me preface this by saying you may find that your husband and you are exactly opposite of the man-woman characteristics that we're going to talk about. Doesn't mean that he's feminine and you're masculine. It just means that for a special reason, God created you in a little different way for a special job. For instance, very creative men who are very artistic many times identify with the subjectiveness that most of us women identify with. And that's for a very special reason. They need to be especially sensitive to people, very creative men. So you may find these exact opposite as we talk. And if you do, we'll just switch around, okay? But remember that if you're opposite of what we're talking about, probably your husband is too. And the reason I say that, I've never seen yet, maybe you're the exception to this, but I've never seen yet a couple that's alike in these things. And there's a reason for that. God created us, men and women, to complement each other, to compensate for each other's weaknesses, and to help each other in our strengths. It's a very beautiful thing God has done in this particular way. Because if we were alike, we'd have the same weaknesses, wouldn't we? And the same strengths. And it wouldn't be this togetherness that God really wants, this unity rather than competition. So God created two eyes to see things from a slightly different point of view. You know, if you only have vision in one eye, you see everything flat. You lose your dimension and perspective. But when you have two eyes, you see things in the round, and you see things with a different perspective. And that's kind of like marriage. God created man and woman with a slightly different point of view so that you can have perspective and dimension in your marriage. And while that will frustrate you because they see things differently than you do, if you learn to appreciate it, and to understand it, it's exciting what it'll do for your marriage. But it'll cause you many hours of frustration, probably, unless you understand it. You know, until I started really studying some of the things that we're going to be talking about today, I probably cried hours needlessly. I was frustrated and upset many times, absolutely without reason, simply because Jack responds as a man. He's a very typical, wonderful man. And I'm probably a very typical, sensitive woman. And so he'd come in the door, and I'd have it all planned in my mind that I was going to say this, and then he was going to say that, and then I was going to say this. And then he'd walk in the door, and you know, he wouldn't say the first thing that I had planned. And I'd get frustrated. And I'd think, how come he doesn't respond the way he ought to respond? You know, why can't a man be more like a woman? Paraphrase the song. Well, Ephesians 4:32 says in the Phillips version, be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. Three very important considerations for marriage in this verse. Be kind. So often we treat strangers so much better than we do our own, don't we? Maybe especially our children. But that's a whole other subject. Courteous, kind. Be understanding. A man once said that a long life is barely enough for a man and a woman to understand each other. And to be understood is to love. The man who understands one woman is qualified to understand pretty well everything. And the reverse of that is true. But how important this is. We take hours of history and English and a whole lot of other subjects in school, don't we? And usually don't use too many of them. But how many hours did we give to really understanding men? To build a successful marriage? To some of these marvelous principles that we need to know in marriage. How much time are you giving it now? Real study. I was reading a book the other day by Mrs. Norman Vincent Peale called The Adventure of Being a Wife. And she says this, if I could give one piece of advice to young brides, and only one, it would be this. Study your man. Study him as if he were some rare and strange and fascinating animal, which he is. Study his likes and dislikes, his strengths and weaknesses, his moods and mannerisms. Just loving a man is fine, but it's not enough. To live with one successfully, you have to know him. And to know him, you have to study him. Look around you and decide how many of the best marriages you know are ones where a wife, in a deep sense, actually knows her husband better than he knows himself. Knows what pleases him. Knows what upsets him. Knows what makes him laugh or makes him happy. Angry. Knows when he needs encouragement. Knows when he's too charged up about something and needs to be held back. Knows, in other words, exactly what makes him tick. What a challenge, huh? And then she talks about the need to adjust to him. And, of course, she goes at it from a wife's angle, and our husbands adjust to us, too. But we're talking just to wives today. And the fact that it's never finished. Jack and I have been married almost 25 years now. It's never finished. Marriage takes work. And marriage takes God's wisdom, as Jack was talking about, to understand these rare creatures, takes wisdom from God. And so we need God in our lives to really accomplish what Mrs. Peale is talking about here. And then she says, if I have developed any real strength of character in my life, it is because I realize that only a woman can be a wife, and only a wife can give this kind of help to her husband. No task is as difficult as this, but the rewards are tremendous. And ladies, they are. The rewards are tremendous as we really give ourselves to this task before us of understanding our sweethearts. And then be forgiving. Ephesians 4 tells us to be forgiving. And of course, forgiving means forgetting. One man says, you know, every time my wife gets angry, she becomes historical. And the other man said, don't you mean hysterical? And the other man said, no, I mean historical. She brings up everything I ever did. We're inclined to do that, aren't we? Many of us. We think we've forgotten it, but boy, we've hidden it down here someplace, ready to be brought up the next time he makes a mistake. And that's not forgiving. Well, as Jack has pointed out, the first thing we've got to do is begin with us. A lot of times we can think, well, if they would do this, you know, we'd be okay. If my husband would really be loving to me, it wouldn't be hard for me. Well, marriage begins with us. From a little book called Magic in Marriage, this man said this: one evening I got into my car and soon began to complain that my windshield must be awfully dirty. "It isn't, Daddy," my little girl said. "You have your sunglasses on." Sure enough, I had slipped the sunglasses on by sheer habit. The moral is, don't judge your partner or your marriage through the distortions of your own unsatisfied ego. I am confident that this kind of judging is the biggest problem most marriages have to face. And then he says on a happy marriage then, for a happy marriage, it becomes exceedingly important to make a periodic appraisal of the level of our own inner fulfillment. Only people who are happy in themselves have any chance of a happy marriage. Unhappy people sometimes withdraw into a marriage as the last resort, but they soon find that happiness cannot be found that way. One marriage manual book I said that I read said that the greatest thing that any person can bring to their marriage is a spirit of happiness. And of course we know that the spirit of happiness, you can't crank up that, can you? You can't say, I am going to be happy, and be happy. It doesn't work that way. And ladies, I've discovered that only as we dwell deep in God is that possible, to have that kind of spirit of happiness, to be a fulfilled person within myself, so that I can bring more to my marriage, so that I'm not making unrealistic demands of my husband to fill all my needs. I've seen a lot of marriages destroyed this way, because a woman expected her husband to meet all the needs of her life, and God didn't create any human being to do that. Not any human being. And so we get disappointed, and then we start blaming them. When here, the problem was the fact that we weren't letting God fulfill our lives, and then letting this beautiful bonus of the man-woman relationship be brought to us from God. Well, Paul Pompano, a noted marriage counselor, says that in his opinion, this difference between men and women that we want to talk about is the greatest cause for distress in marriage. And I really believe this can be true. Apart from not having a relationship with God, this not understanding these basic differences between men and women can cause great and deep heartache. So, it's, of course, sometimes I wonder that they, you know, how they can understand this. Sometimes I don't understand myself, do you? And I think, good grief, it's a good thing I don't have to understand me. I was reading about a lady, I read not long ago about this lady in Los Angeles, who made a left turn into a busy one-way street the wrong way. Instantly, the traffic nodded to a standstill. Finally, a policeman appeared and hustled over to where the woman sat, helplessly enmeshed in her incriminating position. But she beat him to the draw. As he approached, she stuck her head out the window and demanded angrily, "And where were you?" You know, you read about it, and sometimes I catch myself, I think, now, why did I say that? And that must have been a very confusing thing for someone to understand. And yet Proverbs 24, verse 3 says, "By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established." How important is our understanding? Well, let's get into a few of these practical differences. And ladies, I would appreciate it if this would just be a beginning point for you to do some study of your own in this. It takes a lot of study. There's some books like Paul Tournier's To Understand Each Other, Cecil Osborne's How to Understand Your Mate, that are excellent study materials in this very subject. But we find that man is usually the more objective person, and the woman is more subjective. Now, this isn't wrong or right. This, as I said, this is how women and men can fit together and make each other compensate for each other's weaknesses. To a man, a fact is a fact is a fact. To a woman, there are all sides of that fact. There are many things. Two and two maybe don't make four. Maybe they make five or three, depending on how you look at it. Now, a man usually will see things more realistically than a woman because of her subjectiveness. And, of course, as I said, this isn't always true. But if the old illustration of that is of subjectiveness is that a man and a woman might be invited over to your house for dinner. And the man of the party asks you and your husband, where'd you get this meat? And your husband, chances are, would say, at the A&P. And you would think, what's wrong with it? Now, wouldn't you? Most of you? If your husband says, Joe and Sally can't come over for dinner tomorrow night. They've had to make other plans. Your immediate thought is probably, I wonder what we've done to offend them. I was reading into things. Now, you may have been trained that way. You may have been born that way. I don't want to get into that old argument, whether we were raised that way or whether we were born that way. But the fact is, we are that way, most of us. And we get very upset sometimes at our husband's objectivity. Maybe you don't, but I do. And lots of times it appears impersonal to us. Lots of times, because they are so objective, we think they're not really caring. But that's not true. It's the fact that they're objective, and they need to be. They need to see the bigger picture, which is another characteristic. Lots of times they see the big picture, and we see all the little details. Now, in the little humorous article that Jack read, it really is true with most of us that we can be talking on a telephone, stirring the soup, listening to two children at once, and doing a multiplicity of details. And a man really does get upset sometimes when they're trying to be on the phone and the little kid is banging two pot lids together. Because they have there's the single-mindedness about that. And we're created, and rightly so, with being mothers and so on, to handle a great many details. But this is irritating to us sometimes. Did you ever start to tell your husband something about a neighbor? And you start to tell them about this illness that Sue had down the street, and she was in the hospital, and she had that doctor, you know that doctor that whose wife committed suicide, the wife that was the aunt of, and you start going on and on this way. And did you ever look at your husband and see his eyes kind of cross? They get this glazed look. And you think, he's not listening. And you're right. And did you ever get mad at him because of that? And in your mind, you're thinking, he's not interested in what I'm interested in. Therefore, he doesn't really love me the way I want him to love me. Almost always our minds go that way. And we get terribly personal about this. And it goes right down to the depth of his love for us. The fact is, lady, he just really has a very hard time listening to all your details. Because he sees the big picture. And it's very interesting that as I've begun to understand this, how it's helped me to condense details. Oh, you would have been so proud of me the other day. I listened to 4 hours to a long story that a lady was counseling about. 4 hours, and I condensed it for Jack in 10 minutes. And I said, honey, aren't you proud of me? And he said, I really am. It can be done. But it can be a source of irritation. Did you ever have your husband go to a week-long conference and come home and you say, tell me all about it? And they tell you all about it in 5 minutes. And you thought, they're not interested in telling me about it. Well, bless your heart, that's not true. They told you about it. They just told you about it in their way. And we've got to understand that. Got to understand it. On the other hand, they need to learn, and Jack tells them this, to maybe take notes on all the people that are going to have babies and all the engagements and so on, because that's what you're interested in. And they need to learn to do that too. But that's the other side of the coin, isn't it? Her mind for detail can be used, if our husbands will be aware of it. Someone has once said that a woman's intuition is not really intuition at all, but her mind for detail. She goes into a situation and is filtered into her computer of her mind. 20 little details. A raised eyebrow there, a tone of voice there, an inflection there. And it comes out a feeling, an intuition. 90% right. And my husband really uses this. We'll go into a situation and come out of it, and he'll say, "Now, how did you feel about that?" He knows that I can't explain why I feel the way I feel about it. But many times I'm right, because I've picked up things that I'm not even totally aware that I picked up. Whereas he never saw those things, but he saw the big picture. He picked up other things that I never saw. Do you see how you can be used together as you grow together in Christ? God made it that way, and it's very beautiful. So, I remember going to look at a house with a fellow, and a new house that they had just, they were thinking about purchasing. And we came back, and the girl who was living us at the time said, "Tell me about the house." And so I said, "Oh, it's a lovely house. You know, in this one bedroom, the blinds match the wallpaper." And I was going on and on about this house. And this fellow looked at me as though I was describing a totally strange home. And he said, "You're kidding, Carol. Were all of those things in that house?" I says, "Yeah, didn't you see them?" He says, "No. He saw a nice house. And he liked it, and they were going to buy it." But this is the way it works. Your husband might say, "That's a good-looking car, but how does it run?" And you're thinking, "I hate the color." He says, "This is a well-constructed house. It has a well-laid-out plan." And you're thinking, "The wallpaper in the master bedroom was ugly." You pick up those details, and that's great. But you also need to be aware that that they don't think that way as much as you do. Well, I'm going to skip here a little bit. A man, we need to realize, identifies with his life work. His life work is an extension of his personality. A lot of wives have run aground on this one. Whereas a woman many times identifies with her home, and her home is an extension of her personality. It's why you get so upset when your husband neglects things around the home. Do you realize that? Because you're thinking of it as an extension of your personality, and therefore he's neglecting you, and you're taking it personally. He doesn't think that way. It's 20 down on his priority list. And he just doesn't think that way. And you have to be very careful about getting upset when he neglects. On the other hand, you could tell him that. The other side of that coin is that he identifies with his life work, and so when you neglect something about his business, entertaining, a letter that he wants you to write, that may be 20th down on your priority list. But with him, he puts it right up here, and when you neglect it, you're neglecting him many times in his mind. So remember that. Put it away here. And one way to understand this creature that you married. Another very important one is that a man uses speech to express ideas, to convey a fact. A woman many times uses speech to convey feelings. Now, let me illustrate what I mean. You're looking at a moon together. And you say to your husband, "Isn't that the most beautiful moon?" Now, what are you really saying? "Oh, that makes me feel so romantic." You're conveying a feeling, but he may not pick it up as that. And he may say, as my husband once did, in jest he did because he realized this, but he said, "Yeah, it's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by." because by that time he knew what I was trying to convey. It's a whole other subject on communications, but we do speak in coded messages, ladies. And we need to be able to learn how not to do this. It's raining outside. And you look out and you say, oh, it's raining outside. Well, now what are you saying? You could be saying any number of things that he's got to decipher. You could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel very depressed. Or you could be saying, oh, that makes me feel very energetic. I feel like cleaning house. So you could be saying a whole lot of things with that statement. A man says, it's raining outside. They mean the heavens have parted and little drops of moisture are falling to the ground. They're conveying a fact. You're conveying a feeling. And unless you understand that, you're communicating like this. Your wavelength is not even hitting each other. And you're thinking, why doesn't he understand me? And he's thinking, what is she trying to say? Well, what are you going to do about it? Study your man. Study these differences. As I said, maybe you're just opposite. Maybe you're the objective one and he's the subjective one. Maybe he's the detail-minded one and you're the one that thinks in the essentials. Fine, but recognize it, study it, and then ask God for understanding. Be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. How has he forgiven you? Completely. Completely. Do you know that if you've taken Jesus Christ into your life today, he sees you as perfect? Because Christ took care of everything that you've ever done wrong. And if you've accepted that fact, if you've accepted him and invited him into your life, then God sees you as perfect in his eyes. And he can have wonderful fellowship with you and give you the kind of wisdom that you need for this mighty task before you of being the kind of wife that you want to be. How do you see your husband? Do you see him as perfect? Because you've really forgiven him. You know, most men, you might say, well, my husband's 80% good and 20% bad. That'd probably be a pretty high percentage. You can spend the rest of your life building up the 80%. Or the rest of your life complaining about the 20%. And it's up to you. But only God can give you that ability. Give you the spirit of happiness, the kind of wisdom, the kind of joy that you want. Let's pray, shall we?